Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this conversation with John Cochrane. I am delighted to welcome John to record this session, which we also will release as a video and at eSign's Global Economy podcast. I've followed John's work for a long time and always been impressed by his clarity of thought and ability to find approaches to and develop models to key finance and economic issues without overbilling the reader with astonishingly complex algebra, which unfortunately has become the standard in much academic work. John is one of the world's leading economists in his field. He's been researching financial economics and macroeconomics for 40 years and is now the Rosemary and Jack Anderson Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He was previously a professor at the University of Chicago and its Booth School of Business. He's the author of several books and numerous papers on finance, including the leading textbook on asset pricing. He blogs as the Grumpy Economist, and in the past years, he has become a podcast star as one of the three good fellows on the Hoover podcast with the same name, a podcast that, alongside John, also includes historian Neil Ferguson and former national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster. John, it's great to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
So I want us to start talking about inflation and deflation, and especially about a book that you published in early 2020 titled The Fiscal Theory of the Price Level. This is, in my view, a very profound book, and you develop in it a new type of approach for understanding the price level. But before we go into the book and what you are proposing there, why was it necessary to develop a new understanding of what drives changes in the price level? Basically, what is wrong with the old theories and models?
Good. Well, I hope we have a couple hours here. And and you warned me against algebra. No, I'm just joking. Let me be brief. Theory and fact. I started working on this in the 1980s because of the theory problems. And so what are the reigning theories? The classic one is monetarism, that the quantity of money causes inflation. Quantity of money relative to bonds. And that makes sense. The heart of that intuition still remains in the fiscal theory of the price level. You print up too much money, hand it out, you're going to get inflation. The slightly harder question, if you print money and take away people's bonds, does that give people inflation? Not so clear. But that was the reigning theory for many years. The problem with that theory is that that's just not the way the world works. And it crucially requires that central banks control the quantity of money. Our central banks don't control the quantity of money. So money supply equals money demand only controls the price level if you control the money supply. Our central banks set interest rate targets and just done. It's a beautiful theory, but it does not apply to our economy once central banks control interest rate targets. The other reigning theory is a theory of money of inflation with interest rate targets. That is the Keynesian or new Keynesian approach that emerged in the 1990s. When you actually read the equations of these models, so here reading the equations is important. There's something we actually do as economists. You discover it's kind of nutty. And what's nutty is a crucial assumption. What central banks do when they raise inflation in response to, raise interest rates in response to inflation, they are not, as they say, raising interest rates to tamp down demand to bring down inflation. No, read the equations of the models. What they are doing is inflation can be anything. There's multiple equilibria. So that when central banks raise interest rates in response to inflation, they are deliberately exploding and hyperinflating the economy to make us all jump to one of many multiple equilibria that they like. And you're going, what the hell did he just say? And that's exactly what I would say to you. What the heck? That's buried deep in the equations, but that's the heart of how these models all work. Now, 90% of the models is great. It's just this crucial part, which is necessary for how do you establish the price level. So theory, you got the reigning theories with just deep theoretical holes in them. Not so much theoretical holes, deep central assumption that is not how our world works. Our central banks do not set money supplies, they set interest rates, and our central banks do not select multiple equilibria by threatening to blow up the world. That's just not how the world works. facts. Now, especially in the last couple of years, we have elephants in the room distinguishing these theories. And actually, I feel very lucky because our governments just did natural experiments that easily test between the major theories. So monetarism says, if I give you $5 trillion, or in Europe, 5 trillion euros, that will cause inflation. And fiscal theory, which we'll get to, has the same, that will cause inflation. But monetarism says, if I give you 5 trillion euros and take back 5 trillion euros worth of debt, that has exactly the same inflation. Well, our governments just did that experiment for us. Under quantitative easing, they gave us trillions of euros and took back trillions of treasuries. No effect. In the COVID era, they gave us $5 trillion and 5 trillion euros, boom, inflation. So the facts are just screaming that that theory that only the quantity of money matters and not whether it's financing deficits, that turned out to be wrong. Similarly, we hit the zero bound era. When you hit a zero bound, when interest rates are just stuck at zero for 3 decades in Japan, a decade in Europe, almost a decade in the US, classic Keynesian theory says you will see deflation spirals. And people were, you know, honestly warning of this. New Keynesian theory says you will see multiple equilibrium volatility. Inflation will jump up and down all over the place. Fiscal theory says you'll just sleep. What happens? Our economies just slept. So again, you have a really central elephant in the room kind of fact that the classic theories can't account for.
So let's go to your theory. So what is your core theory? What's the new contribution you want to make?
So fiscal theory, the price level, says fundamentally, where does inflation come from? Where does the overall price level come from? Why do we work so hard for these pieces of paper? That's the central puzzle of monetary economics, right? That's what got me interested in it all these years ago. Wow, really puzzling. They're just pieces of paper. They should be worth nothing. In fiscal theory, the answer is because you need these pieces of paper to pay your taxes. It's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is, it's still too much money chasing too many goods. But if there is too much money out there, the government can soak up money by charging taxes, or it can sell bonds to soak up money. But bonds are only worth something if people expect future taxes to soak up the future money that comes from paying off the bonds. So you are led to that the price level is determined so that the real value of government debt is the present value of fiscal surpluses that soak up that debt. Money and government debt are essentially the same thing these days. So if there's too much out, the government soaks it up with current taxes or future taxes, and that's it. Fundamentally, money or bonds are valued because people think the government will pay them back, and they lose value when people think that over the long run, it won't be paid back, exactly the same way stocks work. So this is just prices, present value of dividends applied to the government. If you think a stock is not going to pay dividends, you try to sell it. Everyone tries to sell it. That drives the price up. If we collectively think our governments are not going to get around to paying back this debt, they'll either default or they'll inflate it away later on. What do? We try to get rid of government debt. The only way to get rid of government debt or money is to try to buy stuff, sending the price level up. So that's the fundamental insight of the fiscal theory. And it's interesting. People get this. It's not hard. It's all the confusions of the other theories. It's only if you know too much that this seems controversial.
Well, in a way, you can say also that your book was released at a time when there was a huge experiment going on. We had coming in into the pandemic and sort of going through the pandemic, we had, of course, both monetary and fiscal expansion going on. And then let's say we come in 2022 and we have some people beginning to warn that there are inflationary pressures in the economy. But then we have central banks and others, including Federal Reserve in America, saying that, well, no, we're not really seeing any broad structural trends in the economy which points to that there is inflation coming. Then there is a couple of producer prices going up, and we see shortages coming on in supply chains, and they say, well, this is all transitory. It's going to blow over once supply chains are up and running for real again. But they didn't. What happened, and how does it relate to your theory, John?
So yeah, I'll advertise. I'm not as famous as Larry Summers, but I also was one of the people in early 2021 saying this is going to cause inflation. And in some sense, I'm the luckiest person in the world because, you know, I published the book just then, and it said if you hand up $5 trillion worth of stimulus payments, you're going to get inflation. It's like exercise one of fiscal theory of the price level is what happens if you just hand out $5 trillion or euros, along with no specific plans to pay it back. That's really crucial. Fiscal theory does not say debt and deficits cause inflation. They only cause inflation when there's debt and deficits that people don't believe will be paid back. And that's the crucial thing that caused inflation this time around, as opposed to previous episodes when there was lots of, you know, stimulus now, but we'll pay it back later. That was missing this time. It's interesting that central banks completely missed this. In their forecast, they never saw it. Their targets were 2%. Inflation hit 8%, and their forecast never saw it. They just were out of the business of looking at fiscal stimuluses for inflation. Now, the central banks also, they have this story about supply shocks, which I'm really surprised at because it fails basic economics. And let me explain. There were supply shocks in the pandemic. It's pandemic. You can't go out to dinner. The restaurants are closed. Now, the restaurants weren't closed because we didn't have enough money to spend. The restaurants were closed because there's a pandemic and it was locked down. So it's kind of funny that they went for stimulus to try to repair the economy when the economy was closed down because there's a pandemic. So that was one mistake right there, thinking that this was lack of demand and just needed a lot of money to keep the economy going. But the other part, so a supply shock is a relative price change. If you can't get TVs through the ports that happened in the U.S., the price of TVs has to go up relative to other things. And now that's one price relative to another. That's not all prices together. Inflation is the level of all prices. The price of TVs has to go up relative to wages because we can't buy as many TVs. But why do wages go up? Why does the price of everything go up? So the price level is always set by demand, not by supply. So it's the confusion of relative prices with the overall price level, which is always demand. And it's a confusion of the level of prices with the inflation rate. So if there's a supply shock, you know, like an oil shock, the price of oil goes up and then the price comes back down again. So the price level doesn't increase over time. Well, what we happened was inflation went up and came down, but the price level is still 20% higher than it used to be. So supply shocks there were supply shocks. That's what caused central banks and governments to flood the world with demand. The central banks and governments don't like any price to go down, so they would rather have inflation. So we have inflation because they accommodated the supply shock. But the supply shock didn't cause the inflation. The supply shock is the carrot. The horse is fiscal and monetary policy, and that pulled the cart of inflation. So supply shocks then kind of turned into a dog ate my homework excuse. It wasn't our fault. But to which I would ask central banks, look, your target is 2. It hit 8 in the U.S. and 10 in the Eurozone. If you're just saying, oh, well, supply shocks hit, you're telling us that you have no control over this thing. And then in the next supply shock, we're going to have another 8 or 10. Let's have a little more serious discussion about supply shocks.
And I mean, if we take this episode and go into it a little bit more and also connect it to the previous discussion on what's wrong with previous models, I would assume that a traditional monetarist would say, well, we also managed to get this one right. We'd seen money supply going up pretty substantially during the pandemic at the same time as money velocity was going down because we were in our homes and we couldn't spend the money that much. So wouldn't you, on the basis of that simplistic type of approach, say that, well, we're going to end up in an episode where too much money is chasing too few goods. So inflation is going to be the consequence of it.
Yeah, it's my friends, the monetarists are taking a victory lap because finally it seemed to be working. Since 1980, money has had nothing to do with inflation, but our government sent people checks. The supply of money went up. People started to spend it and we got inflation. Yahoo, say the monetarists. Of course, fiscal theory agrees. Sending people checks is just a form of sending people government debt and making it clear you have no way of repaying it. So we agree that's going to cause inflation. The acid test for a monetarist is whether if I then send you money and take back your bonds in equal amount, is that going to cause exactly the same inflation? That was quantitative easing. So although they like to, you know, cherry pick that one data point, money inflation, there's the previous data point, exactly the same amount of money, but I took back the bonds. I didn't finance a deficit, no inflation. So sorry, guys, you don't get to cherry pick data points. I would say, too, there's sort of a lack of honesty. You don't have to be totally fiscal theory to understand why we got inflation. This is classic things that have happened over and over again. Every time there's a war, what governments do is they spend like crazy. They print money in order to finance the spending. They hold interest rates down to improve the debt. And you get a bout of inflation, which inflates away some of the existing debt. So everyone, the pain goes to existing bondholders. Classic war finance. That's what we did in COVID. It's standard economics. We've done it for hundreds of years. You could just be honest and say, guys, we're doing, the fancy word is a Lucas Stokey state contingent default. We're going to spend like crazy here, and we're going to take 20% off the top of existing bondholders by inflation to do it. Just as we did in World War I, World War II, Civil War, Revolutionary War, and 15 times in Europe. Second story that's been forever, when there's a supply shock, some prices go up, some prices go down. We central banks don't like any price to go down. So when there's a supply shock, what we're going to do is make all the prices go up. We're going to accommodate it with demand. That's what we did. That's what we always will do. But, you know, and that's in every textbook. In the 1970s, there was an oil supply shock. What did central banks do? They accommodated it with demand, and we got inflation. So this is not a big surprise, and yet everybody's making it such a big deal. Now, I guess if you're honest about it, then you're saying, well, in the next crisis, this is all going to happen again, and no one wants to be honest about that fact, or face, why don't we rearrange our affairs so it doesn't have to happen again in the next crisis?
You mentioned previously the zero low bound age and the thinking that underpinned, I think, a lot of the economic analysis that central banks and others had at the time. And that thinking was basically, so we are in a sort of a deflationary cycle in the global economy with China going into the world economy, offering new competition, there is more trade, there is outsourcing, and that's going to pressure down price increases and gradually lead to underlying low inflation momentum in the economy. And that is going to, again, take us into a territory where traditional tools of monetary policy is going to be difficult to operate because, you know, we have a low natural interest rate in the economy. And what can we do if we need to stimulate the economy? But they did try to stimulate the economy, and they did try to do it with negative interest rates. There was also, I mean, central banks that were trying to reliquidate the economies in different ways. So if we, I mean, you've already been pointing to this, but if we go through it a bit more structurally, why didn't that work? Why didn't we manage to reinflate the economy along those lines as basically we were told was going to happen?
Well, eventually we really inflated the economy just fine.
We did, yes. Yes, we did, but it took a while.
It took a while. And it's because, you know, once you've been responsible with your fiscal policy for a long time, it's hard to convince people that you're going to be irresponsible without turning right away into Argentina. But I think the way you pose the question reveals some of the confusion around monetary policy. And it's this confusion, this a lack of understanding how it works that really motivated me to work on it. There's the conventional doctrine just has no correspondence with our economic model. So the conventional doctrine is, for some reason, real interest rates became low. That forces nominal interest rates, what central banks charge, to come down as well. And then you get into the zero bound. But then you said the words deflationary cycle. And that's classic old Keynesian thinking. That's spiral thinking, which is, so then when the interest rate hits zero, if there's deflation, now the real interest rate is high. That causes less aggregate demand, less, and then draws inflation down. So that's the prediction of the deflationary spiral. That never happened. You know, look at Japan. They hit zero. They had, you know, occasionally 1 or 2% deflation, but nothing terrible. It never went out of control. The deflationary spiral turned out not to exist. You can just sit at zero interest rates, slightly low inflation, slightly in the US and Europe, 1.7% inflation. In Japan, you know, between negative one. They had a stable price level for 30 years, essentially zero inflation, zero interest rates. Milton Friedman called that the optimal quantity of money. And what's so terrible about that? We've had periods, you know, period like the late 1800s. There's a period of slow deflation in the US and Europe. We grew like gangbusters. In the end, real things and nominal things don't have anything to do with each other. So you can blame money for business cycles, but you can't blame money for low growth. Low growth over decades is because of sclerotic microeconomic policies. So you know, the very logic there was proved wrong, and I'm not sure anything was so terrible about those years. Now, yeah, it does show the limited power of central banks, which I think Milton Friedman won a little bit too much. you got to understand, in the 1940s, 50s, and early 60s, nobody thought central banks had anything to do with inflation. Inflation was waged by price spirals and union negotiations and habits and so forth. And then Friedman came along, so central banks. Now we think central banks have their hand on the level of inflation completely. Well, we learned a little bit in the zero bound era. Central banks changing interest rates is very loosely connected to inflation. Certainly, they lost control in the recent spurt of inflation. There are fiscal shocks that, it would be interesting to see what would have happened had central banks reacted quickly and not slept for a whole year to try to fight them. And I think suspect going forwards, we're going to find out that raising interest rates is a limited tool. It's not so obvious that they are in as much control as you think. And the zero bound era is sort of proof of that pudding. Certainly quantitative easing, that put the monetarist idea to the test. That was an atom bomb in terms of printing money and giving out money, taking in treasuries, open market operations, had no effect whatsoever.
So, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, in all of that, and also in the exaggerations we usually place on central banks when it comes to controlling, well, not just inflation, but other forms of aggregates as well. But that seems to be still what central banks have been doing, and perhaps what the rest of the world have been looking at central banks to do over the past 2 years as well, when after the spike in inflation, everyone has been thinking that this is something for central banks to fix. What would be your approach to dealing with a situation when price levels has increased as it did, and we have inflationary pressures in the economy? What do you do then?
Well, central banks certainly can act. Now, here I have to step a little outside the models, because it's interesting how little economists actually know about what higher interest rates do to inflation. When you look at the equations of the models, we know a lot less than the thing. So I'm going to kind of merge what I know with equations with what I sort of suspect is true. But even in fiscal theory, central banks are very important for setting inflation. And they can, by raising interest rates more quickly, they could certainly have smoothed out the inflation that came from fiscal policy. They couldn't have gotten rid of it completely, but they could have made it a lot lower, although possibly a lot longer. So central banks have a big role to play in sort of guiding the path of inflation. But in the past, central banks have worked together with fiscal policy. And I'll just give you one of the most important mechanisms that leads me to worry now. So when a central bank raises interest rates in order to fight inflation, and let's posit that has some effect on lowering inflation, which is already a bit of a problem in contemporary theory. But when they raise interest rates, that raises interest costs on the debt for the governments. And that's a big effect now. So 100% debt to GDP, 1% interest rate is 1% of GDP more deficit to pay the interest costs on the debt. This is real money now, 1% of GDP yep. extra deficit. And if they raise interest rates, 2% of GDP more deficit. Now, in every model and in historical episodes that have been successful, when the central bank raises the interest rate, 1%, 2%, 3%, the fiscal policy tightens. They raise taxes, they cut spending, or economic growth comes in to help. But the fiscal policy pays the extra interest on the debt. Now, our governments are not in great fiscal shape. So I think a big question right now is, if they raise interest rates and if they raise, therefore, interest costs on the debt, are the governments going to say, oh yeah, sure, no problem, we're going to cut spending? There's not much room to raise taxes, especially in Europe. We're going to cut spending 1-3% of GDP to finance interest payments to your wealthy fat cat bondholders. Really, they're going to do that? And if they don't, all current models, even new Keynesian models, monetarist models, old Keynesian models, if they don't, if fiscal policy does not help, then higher interest rates can't control inflation. So I think we got some worries ahead about whether even the ability of central banks that we've seen to lower inflation, whether that comes from the cooperation of fiscal policy and whether it will still work when fiscal policy can't help. To say nothing of, if you raise interest rates, that causes recessions. That makes people unhappy, and it also causes fiscal policy to have more stimulus and bailouts and so forth. If you raise interest rates, that means all the too big to fail banks are in trouble again and need another big bailout. If you raise interest rates in Europe, Italy and France are in even more trouble. So the ability of central banks to fight inflation by raising interest rates may be much more constrained next time around than it has in the past.
All right, John, let's turn to Europe. And as a first port of call, the euro and the European Central Bank. You have been working on a book together with Luis Garicano and Klaus Masuch, I think I pronounce his surname correctly, a book which is coming out next year, looking at the development of the euro and actions taken by the ECB. So what's the problem that needs fixing with the euro?
Well, the euro is a wonderful thing. So there's American economists who sort of parachute in and propound on the euro. So at least I have two good European co-authors who are, and they're great. They both understand things. Klaus Masuch, I think it is, has at the central bank and was the guy in charge of Greece. So he really, one of us really knows what he's doing here.
So, and Luis was also in Brussels for 2 years as a member of the European Parliament. So
yes,
we know he's good.
And Luis also has, I'll advertise his blog too, his Substack, which is taking on European growth, which is really the current issue in Europe is stagnant growth. Forget about money, interest rates, inflation, you know, stagnant growth and so many rules that you can't get anything done is Europe's number one problem. But we're not here to talk about that yet, I guess. You asked me a question, the euro. So I think the euro is wonderful. And I'm sorry for all those American economists who parachute in and say it's a stupid idea. Because the U.S. has one currency for something the size of the euro. Why shouldn't Europe have one currency? One currency makes trade easier, internet, you know, that just helps the integration of the European Union. But there's this problem, and it's a central problem for Europe, that the connection of fiscal and monetary policy. And the people who designed the euro were really, when we look back, they were really brilliant. They understood this problem. And the problem is, it's already... In the U.S., it's already a problem that there's a temptation for a government to run deficits and then call up the central bank and say, how would you like to print up some money to pay off this debt, which we don't want to raise taxes to pay off? And that's a problem in any fiat money regime. Now, in Europe, it's worse because there's a temptation for Italy or now France or Greece to run up a bunch of debt and then call up the European Central Bank and say, crisis, crisis, you got to print up money to pay off our debt. Now, the founders of the euro understood this, and the euro was brilliantly set up to try to control this problem. The rules were the European Central Bank had a mandate, only worry about inflation, don't worry about anything else. You will only set short-term interest rates. You will not buy government debts. And there will be debt and deficit limits so that governments don't get in trouble in the first place. There's a few holes in it because, of course, you can't write a rule book for every possible contingency at the outset. And one of the holes is they never really had the clarity to say, in a currency union, governments must default just like businesses. You know, if a big business can't pay its debts, it doesn't get to call up and say central bank being, well, it's not supposed to be able to. They do, but it's supposed to be able to default. So when you're in a currency union, a government is just like a business. It has to be able to default, and there needs to be mechanisms to allow it to default without bringing down the financial system. And in the original setup, they understood the problem, but they didn't quite say, well, governments are going to default and here's how. They sort of said, well, the debt and deficit limits will mean that, well, that'll never happen. Well, it promptly did happen. And then we got a financial crisis that nobody expected in the 1990s would happen. You can't blame the founders of the euro for not saying, well, see, if we have a global financial crisis that no one's seen since the 1930s, what's going to happen? They kind of said, you know, here's the basic idea. You guys figure it out when the time comes. And of course, in the financial crisis, the ECB had to, break a lot of rules and buy a lot of debts and do all the things it did. And then there's the sovereign debt crisis, where Greece was on the edge of defaulting and maybe Italy and Spain and so forth. And, they muddled through by buying a lot of sovereign debt. And then they kind of put the genie back in the bottle in a way we describe in the book, mechanisms for helping governments for arranging things. We still have a problem that sovereign debts are stuffed in banks. So Greek banks hold Greek bonds. So if Greece defaults, all the Greek banks go under. Greek banks should hold German bonds so that the Greek government can default without bringing down its financial system. So that the fact that banking is still so national and not so euro is part of the fragility here. But then with COVID, we went back to it. So now the ECB holds a lot of sovereign debt. And starting with whatever it takes, everybody expects that any slight blip up in Italian yields and Greek yields and French yields that will lead to the ECB intervening to hold down sovereign yields and buying the debt. So it's the problem of every crisis. In a crisis, you're going to bail out. I'm going to bail out. You're going to bail out. You know, that's what you do in a crisis. But in the intercrisis period, you try to set the system up so it's not so fragile and your hand isn't forced. And that was really the failing of, we got through the crisis, we bailed everyone out, great, we're done. And we never really got into how do we structure the mechanisms so that we're not forced to do that again. So that's where the euro is. And just to cut it a little bit short, sorry, I'm giving the whole book here. We have a detailed list of how to get back to a system where the ECB isn't forced in every crisis to buy up a ton of sovereign debt. And governments don't have this incentive to just keep borrowing, knowing that the ECB will come bail them out.
So a classic moral hazard problem, basically. So you have to, in a crisis, I mean, you don't have much choice, but then you need to fix the institutional and incentives in when you're not in a crisis. And that's what we need to do now, right?
That's right. And of course, the problem is after the crisis, there's maybe a year or two of interest in fixing the incentives, and then everyone goes to sleep again. And that's human nature. Yeah, in a crisis, nobody worries about moral hazard in a crisis. The saying is there are no atheists in foxholes. But then once you get out, is time to try to fix those incentives.
All right, very good. So you said Europe's problem right now has very little to do with money. What's the problem with Europe? Is it a different type of rot which has been spreading in our economy, which leads us to, basically no growth? I mean, countries like Germany have negative economic growth. Brighter lights in the European economy, especially Eastern and Central Europe, but most of the continent seems to be permanently demoted to low economic expectations. So what are we doing wrong?
Yeah, Eastern Europe, I mean, the great thing of Europe is it's still a bright shining light to everybody in the East. Poland's doing great. Now, a lot of that is what we call in economics catch-up growth. So there's frontier growth where you have to invent new ways of doing things, and there's catch-up growth where you're recovering from communism and you just have to put in the institutions to get things right. And that's what's going on in Eastern Europe. But of course, there's lots of places where that doesn't happen. So it's a great bright light. And Europe should be proud that so many people on the East are just dying to join Europe as fast as possible, like Ukraine, for example, or Georgia, where, fighting hard to join. So, we're depressed about low growth, but things could be worse. So let's keep this wonderful project alive is the way I'd like to put it. But I think it's becoming clear, and I'm glad to see it's becoming clear, that a decade of low growth, in some places more, Italy's GDP per capita is going down since like 2010. Germany was doing great, but is no longer doing great. And I don't think it's a great mystery what's happened. Some of it is the remaining fragmentation. But it seems even Mario Draghi is perfectly clear. Brussels has sent out regulations that nobody can comply with. And here I'll particularly advertise Luis Garicano's blog, because he just did a wonderful piece on AI regulation in Europe, which makes it clear why all of the AI is being developed in the US and not in Europe, because you can't even get off the ground before you file 100 pieces of paper with Brussels. And when you look at the number of companies, over 100 million that have been founded in the last 50 years in Europe, it's practically none. And all of the big stuff happening, now the US is not great either. We have a vast overregulation problem. Our long-term growth was 4% from the end of World War II to 2000, and is down to 2% now. So U.S. long-term growth is a screaming problem, but we're doing better than everybody else because, you know, we don't have quite the Brussels layers of regulation. On top of which, you know, Germany's energy policies are just screaming. You get rid of nuclear power, which emits zero carbon, dear Germans, at the same time as you import gas from Russia and burn coal from Eastern Europe. And it's been horrendously expensive. Industry is leaving because you can't get electricity. These are self-inflicted wounds, which, by the way, are not doing a whole lot for carbon emissions. Even the U.S. is doing wonderfully on carbon emissions because fracking, which isn't allowed in Europe, lets us burn natural gas, which is, you know, it emits CO2, but it emits half the CO2 of coal. Boom, down go the emissions. So, that's an example of the kinds of self-inflicted wounds that come to roost. But primarily that the lack of economic dynamism, the ability to start new companies, do new things, Europe really has to face this. It has nothing to do with money and inflation. Don't blame the ECB.
Yeah. So, I mean, you pointed to Mario Draghi and his report, and which, of course, has been widely discussed around Europe over the past couple of months, even if I doubt that many policymakers have actually read it in full and understood what he's saying. But there's one element.
Just a minute. I didn't want to fully endorse it, because what I thought was brave was the diagnosis that standing up and saying this emperor has no clothes, the overregulation is stifling the economy. Now, he went on to say we need industrial policy and targeted subsidies and take economies with 100 to 160% of debt to GDP ratios and borrow more money and throw it down more government rat holes. I'm not going to endorse that part. But just standing up and saying we have a long-run structural problem of overregulation was brave and wonderful.
Yeah. No, because that's what I was going to come to, which is that if you follow his diagnosis, he sounds pretty much like John Cochrane when he trying to point out what's problematic with Europe. But then when it comes to the solution, he sounds more like Joe Biden, which is to spend a lot of money, industrial policies, looking at giant packages. Perhaps some of it's going to be privately funded, but trying to release money through pension funds and others in order to be invested in the European economy. And that seems to me not just to be, well, pretty much impossible to achieve in a fragmented political structure as Europe is, but it doesn't seem to substantively be the right policy either. So what is it that we need to do? Cut regulation? Is that the recipe for taking us forward?
Yeah, get out of the way. The number one good public policy is get out of the way. There's these words. You use the words release capital, and the ECB likes to say mobilize capital, unlock capital. Every time you hear a word like that, watch for your wallet. Because capital isn't released. Why is capital not investing in Europe? Because they can't get the permits. not because it's locked up somewhere.
Could also be that you don't get much return if you invest money.
Exactly. So encouraging, public investment in negative rate of return projects, that is exactly how to make growth worse. And Europe has plenty of experience with this. You've had state-run companies that have been rat holes for public funds and low efficiency investment for decades. Let's get away from that. And part is the tragedy of Europe. Europe's free trade, common market, and common currency should have led to an explosion of growth. Things are worse than you think, because you have this great headwind of taking small countries and putting them together, the great tailwind of that. And so the regulatory headwind must have been huge to stop that from causing the growth. And it is really shocking the size of it. Typical European countries are 30 to 40% of GDP per capita below the US. The US, let me tell you, we are no paragon of libertarian free market paradise over here. We're a overregulated, stifled, overtaxed economy, just like Europe, only a little bit less so. But 30 to 40% of income year after year, that is an enormous gap. And, you only have to achieve US levels of dysfunction for everybody's income to rise 30 to 40%, for 10 years of 3 to 4% growth a year. Just be as dysfunctional as we are, and this is lying on the plate. So, I think that's a real challenge for Europe.
I mean, you have, if I'm not mistaken, John, I mean, not long ago, you moved from the People's Republic of Illinois to the People's Republic of California. And so I think for a lot of people in Europe watching American developments right now, they're going to be in awe, especially when it comes to tech sector, innovation, productivity, growth coming from the tech sector. But that's just one part of the economy. What is the dysfunction in the US economy? Because, I mean, California maybe sort of have parts that are doing well, but not the other parts. Chicago area is also pretty much in a dismal political situation too. So what's going on?
Yeah, we have all the same politically caused diseases as lots of parts of Europe that aren't growing. California, it is still the heart of tech and sort of it's where tech gets developed. But the minute you can move operations out of California, they do. So in fact, it is not really a booming part of the economy. It's where the venture capital is and it's where the startup are. But the operations move to Austin, Texas as fast as they humanly can, because we have the same combination of insanely high taxes, very difficult regulation, and it's the hidden kind of regulation. It's like you can't get the permits kind of regulation. So California has very stringent housing restrictions and business development restrictions. It takes years and years to get the permit to do anything. And that just means that you can't build an office building. You can't bring employees to near where they work. Housing is insanely expensive because there's a small supply of houses anywhere near where the work is. So you just can't bring workers to where the opportunities are, which, by the way, if you worry about inequality and low-income people, the fact that they are stuck in places where there's terrible jobs is in part because you're not allowed to build apartments for them near where the good jobs are. And there's hope, though, because even the progressive left in the U.S. is figuring this out. They figured it out when they said, we want solar panels and windmills. And then they discovered they're stuck in court for 10 years fighting over the habitat of some tortoise. It's not really even fighting over actual environmental issues. The way it works in the U.S. is you fight over whether the paperwork was filled out correctly to address the environmental issues. You don't actually do the environmental issues. It's just how to stop projects in my backyard. Well, they figured out I'm not able to connect my solar panels to the grid for 10 years. And if you're a climate extremist, well, the Earth's going to fry by the time I've actually gotten this solar panel connected. So they are now realizing that we've created a bureaucratic mess and need to do something to get projects going. But we have the same, it's even in some places worse than the U.S., the bureaucratic bloat on doing things. California tried to build a high-speed train. We're now 15 years into the project, $130 billion down. SNCF, the French railway company, looked at it and said, "You got to be kidding. This is such a disaster. We're going to go build trains in Morocco instead." So we're built, when you build stuff in the U.S., it costs five times what it costs in libertarian free market France to build things. So we have plenty of regulatory snafus, just like Europe. But we do have, the tech companies can get away with it. We are still slightly a society of rights, not of permissions. and you can still, I have the right to start this company, and I don't need that many permissions from regulatory authorities to do it. And that's that ability of the weeds to come grow through the cracks is what keeps the U.S. economy going.
And how do you expect the U.S. economy to and U.S. economic policy to evolve going forward? I mean, I when I listen to some discussions taking place by, you know, economists or semi-economists or at least people with an interest in economic policy, I hear one argument, which is that they want to effect more of a structural change to the U.S. economy, which is that, you know, we are going to exit the period of globalization where we could raise prosperity by having more competition coming from abroad, reducing consumer prices, or at least moderating the growth of consumer prices so people would get more welfare. Now they want to end that period to have less trade, perhaps more protectionism, and instead try to rejig the economy so there is more coming from domestic productivity generation type of salary increases. And that seems to me to unite some parts of the left and some parts of the right in America now. What do you say?
Yeah, we're at a big inflection point one way or the other. The voters looked at the Biden economy and said, we don't want any more of that, which is, it was a very European vision of where the economy should go. Trillions of dollars down various rat holes that are just going to get wasted. And you know, checks being sent out, you know, the U.S. forgave $400 billion of student loans on the signature of a president, that kind of thing. But they saw the inflation, they saw the regulatory onslaught, and they said, no. Now, what are we going to get instead? And there's, you know, there's in from my sort of free market point of view, there's the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other shoulder, and we'll see which one wins out in the Trump administration. We are certainly shaking things up. So one impulse is this anti-globalization impulse, big tariff barriers, protections, industrial policy, you know, the same habit of throwing money down rat holes, just a different set of rat holes to try to, you know, it's kind of, they say build back the economy of the 1950s, which is sadly true. The economy in the 1950s was terrible. We are seven times richer than we were in the 1950s, but there were, you know, protectionist barriers. Globalization is not just cheap stuff from China. It is economies of scale. You can't afford to develop an iPhone unless you can sell it around the world. You can't afford to develop AI unless you can sell it around the world. You can't afford to develop the miraculous new drugs that are coming along unless you can sell it around the world. So what we're going to lose is not just cheap consumer goods from China. What we're going to lose is the economies of scale that allow the next generation of wonderful ideas to bring us back to growth. So that would be a tragedy if that's the way we go. But there's another instinct going on. There's Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy who are going to take Javier Milei's chainsaw to U.S. regulations. Good luck to them, because there are a lot of people out there who like to defend those regulations. There's a lot of the economists I know who are going to be working for Trump who are devoted free marketers, deregulators, and so forth. So one can put in a lot of what looks like tariffs in a way that doesn't actually hurt things that much. The U.S. economy grew quite well despite heavy tariffs in the late 1800s, despite, not because of. So, you know, tariffs themselves are, they're damaging, but not terribly damaging necessarily. Tariffs are way better than quotas. You know, you just need to pay an extra 20%, you can get it in. Quotas, it can be worth 100%, 200%, 300%, and you never know. So, you know, we may do a lot of lip service to the whatever the new conservatives call themselves, but in fact become a dynamic, much more deregulated economy. We'll see which way it comes out. There's two possibilities.
And we are very soon going to end, John, but just to add one more question on that topic. So as you said, I mean, the notion here seems to be that you can deregulate internally, you can cut taxes, and then you can increase border barriers to the rest of the world. And the balance of these measures are going to speak in favor of growth anyway. Do you think that's correct?
That's a possibility. I mean, growth in all of our economies, growth is always despite a lot of stuff. There's a lot of damage going on in our economy. But, you know, we can grow reasonably well, even though every single policy isn't perfect. So I'm an economist. I would lose my union card if I said tariffs were a good thing. But tariffs aren't necessarily as bad as, you know, the kinds of things that the Harris-Biden people were proposing to do. So I think we can grow despite tariffs, especially if they are low, sensible, not managed in a terrible way. I mean, tariffs, it's very much in the details of the implementation of how much damage they cause to the economy. So I'm hopeful for the good parts, and let's hope the bad parts don't hurt too much.
John, that was a great way of ending our conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And if you ever get tired of Elon Musk and Ramaswamy cutting regulations in America, do send them over to Europe.
Yes, with pleasure.
Thank you so much.